and at 6.5 inches, it's too small for many kitchen tasks. It's got neither the heft of the Misono nor the Granton edge and solid feel of the Wusthof, but it's a great knife by most standards. 2. A 3-4 inch sheep's foot paring knife. For many years, I used a classic curved 3-inch paring knife from Wusthof, and at first glance, the shape of the classic paring knife seems to make sense. A big curved chef's knife is for cutting, hacking, and chopping large things, so to cut, hack, and chop small things, you'd want to use a small version of a chef's knife, right? Thing is, there's a fundamental difference between how you use a paring knife and how you use a chef's knife, so why would you want them both to be the same shape? The real problem with the common paring knife is the curvature of the blade. With a chef's knife, this curve is designed to allow you to rock the knife for mincing. But for a paring knife, it makes no sense. Nobody is rocking a paring knife. The key to a good paring knife is precision, and that means having a super thin blade and the ability to make cuts with minimal hand motion. The more you have to move your hand, the more uneven the cut becomes. A flat sheep's foot shaped knife is ideal for this task. With a sheep's foot knife, it's possible to make contact with the cutting board with nearly the entire length of the blade while the tip is firmly inserted into the food. The straightness of the cut is defined by the straightness of the blade. Quicker, more precise, and less chance for user error are all pluses in my book. The same reasoning applies even more strongly if you are using the knife to peel small things, like little potatoes or grapes. When using a curved paring knife, the curve of the blade and the curve of the object you are peeling run in opposite directions, so almost none of the food actually comes in contact with the blade, requiring you to dig deeper and remove more flesh than is necessary. Those of you who are used to using sentoku knives in place of chef's knives will immediately recognize these advantages. The 3-inch Kudamono hollow edge paring knife from Henkels, $50, is one of the cheapest decent knives of this kind you can get, with the added advantage of having a hollow ground Granton edge. You can get the 3-inch sheep's foot paring knife from Wusthof for the same price. It lacks the Granton edge, but it is slightly heavier, sturdier, and feels better in the hand. If you want what I consider to be the ultimate paring knife, tack on another $5 to get the same Wusthof but with a Granton edge. That's the one my knife kit packs. 3. A 10-12 inch serrated bread knife. I'm far less picky about bread knives than I am about chef's knives. For one thing, I don't use them often. For cutting soft breads like burger buns or sandwich bread, my chef knife is more gentle than a bread knife. In fact, just about the only thing I use my bread knife for is cutting crusty bread, like a baguette or a rustic Italian loaf. If you never eat these, you have no need for a bread knife. That's why I don't feel the need to make sure my bread knife fits in my hand like a glove. And since serrated blades are difficult, if not impossible, to sharpen at home, a bread knife won't last you as long as your chef's knife will. You'll find bread knives with pointed teeth, scalloped teeth, and micro serrations. I find that the best knives have wide, sharp teeth, a forged, not stamped blade for better sharpness and weight, and a good length. My first bread knife was the Zwilling J.A. Henkels Twin Pro-S 8-inch bread knife, about $85, and it served me well for about a decade. My current bread knife is the F. Dick forged 8-inch bread knife, about $65. It works just as well as the Henkels. If you're on a tighter budget, you could do worse than the Victorinox Fibrox bread knife, around $25. 4. A 6-inch boning knife. Sure, you don't think you're going to be doing a lot of boning in your kitchen. Wait, that came out wrong. Let's start over. You may not be removing the bones from any chickens or pigs' legs right now, but I hope I'll be able to convince you that those are both good skills to have under your belt. It not only saves you money, lots of it, but it also increases the deliciousness you are able to produce in your kitchen. We'll get to why later on. A boning knife should be thin and moderately flexible, with a very sharp tip. The idea is that you want to be able to get that knife in between all the meat and the bones, working your way in, out, and around structures that aren't necessarily straight. A thin, flexible blade aids in this process. A good boning knife should also be made with a foot, an extra bit of metal jutting out of the heel, which you can use to scrape meat and connective tissue off the bones to clean them. I've yet to find a more capable boning knife than the Wusthof Classic 6-inch flexible boning knife, about $85. 5. A good heavy cleaver. First things first, avoid expensive Japanese or German cleavers, period. If they sell it at Williams-Sonoma, you don't want it. A cleaver is meant to be for only the toughest of the tough jobs, and it will get beat up. It doesn't require the razor-sharp edge-maintaining abilities of expensive German or Japanese steel, so there's no sense in paying a higher price for one when cheaper models are just as serviceable. My favorite is a heavy-duty 2-pound full-tang 8-inch bladed behemoth of a cleaver that I got for $15 at a restaurant supply store in Boston's Chinatown. I use it nearly daily for taking apart chickens, hacking through animal bones, mincing beef or pork for hand-chopped burgers or dumplings, cleaving hearty vegetables, and trying to look really badass in the mirror. It's not so good at that particular function. If you live near a restaurant supply store, check it out for similar deals. As with all knives, you're looking for solid construction and a full tang. A cleaver should be plenty heavy as well. Alternatively, you can get the more mass-market 7-inch wood-handled cleaver from Dexter Russell, about $40. It's a tad more expensive, you're paying for the label, but it does exactly what it's supposed to do, hack the shit out of things. 6. A Y-shaped vegetable peeler. A regular vegetable peeler has a blade aligned with the handle, requiring you to hold both vegetable and peeler at an awkward angle, limiting your precision. With a Y-peeler, you hold the peeler as if you're picking up an iPod, giving you far greater accuracy. The result is prettier vegetables, faster prep once you get used to using it, and less waste. The Kuhn Rakan Original Swiss Peeler, $10.95 for 3, comes in assorted colors, has a built-in potato eye remover, and is cheap, sturdy, and very sharp. I bought a set of a half dozen in 2002 and still have 4 of them in perfect working order. For the record, the other 2 were lost, not broken or worn out. 7. A 10-inch honing steel. Honing steels, sometimes incorrectly referred to as sharpening steels, are the long, heavy, textured metal rods that butchers and serial killers run their knives over before going at their meat. Many people confuse honing with sharpening, but there is a distinct difference. When you sharpen a knife, you're actively removing material from the blade, creating a brand new razor-sharp beveled edge. When you hone a knife, all you're doing is making sure that edge is straight. The thing about metal is, it's malleable. That means that with regular kitchen use, that thin, sharpened edge can get microscopic dents in it that throw the blade out of alignment. Even if the blade is still sharp, it can feel dull because the sharp edge has been pushed off to the side. That's where a honing steel comes in. When used properly, a steel will realign the edge of the blade so that the sharpened bit is all facing in the right direction. You should steel your knife with every cooking session to ensure that you're getting the best edge possible. When purchasing a steel, look for a heavy model at least 10 inches long. I use the Wusthof 10-inch steel, which costs about $20. Just like a good knife, a high-quality steel will last a lifetime. The ridges may wear out over time, but don't worry, it's still doing its job. Diamond steels are gaining more popularity these days. These are honing steels that have fine diamond powder embedded in them. This allows them to shave off a microscopic amount of edge material every time you run your knife across one of them. In this sense, they truly are sharpening steels. The advantage of using them is that you'll be able to slightly increase the time between true stone sharpenings. High-quality models tend to run a little more than twice as much as regular honing steels. Cutting boards. A good cutting board is as important as good knives. The ideal cutting board is large enough to give you ample space to work on, at least 1 foot by 2 feet, preferably much larger. Heavy enough that it doesn't slip, slide, or break under the pressure of a heavy slam from a cleaver, and made of a material that is soft enough that it won't dull your blade. Of the types of boards on the market, plastic, polyethylene, and wood are the only ones you should consider. A glass cutting board is like death to your blade. Slow, painful, agonizing death as, stroke after stroke, the perfect edge that you worked so hard to achieve is relentlessly worn away. A few years back, if you'd asked a health expert which type to use, they would have said plastic, not wood. Plastic is inert and inhospitable to bacteria, they'd say, whereas wood can house dangerous bacteria and transfer them to your food. Turns out those health experts were wrong. A number of recent airtight studies have shown that wood is actually less likely to be a means of transferring bacteria due to its natural antimicrobial properties. A wooden cutting board can be a death trap for bacteria. So long as you give it a scrub and a thorough drying after each use, which, of course, you should do with plastic boards as well, it's a perfectly safe material. As for its actual function as a cutting surface, wood also takes home the gold, with some modern plastic boards coming in a close second. Wood is very soft, meaning that your knife can make great contact with every stroke, but it also has some self-healing properties. Stroke marks will close up and fade away, though with repeated use, your board will become thinner and thinner. I'm lucky enough to have a few large, heavy, butcher block-style boards, which I received as a gift from an old chef of mine, that exactly fit my prep area. The best commercial models I've seen are the ones made by Ironwood Gourmet. They have a 20 by 14 inch version for about $50 that'll last you at least half a lifetime. Don't have the dough to spend? A plastic one is not ideal, but it will do just fine. The OXO Good Grips 15 by 21 inch version is a quarter of the cost and a great value. With a wooden board, you want a small bottle of mineral oil to rub into the surface with a soft cloth or paper towel after each use to prevent staining and enhance its life. Feeling sharp. There is nothing more frustrating than a dull knife. Not only does it make prep work a chore and your finished product less attractive, it's also downright dangerous. A dull blade requires more pressure to cut into a food, and it can easily slip off a tough onion skin, for example, and into your finger. Ouch! Most home cooks should sharpen their knives at least twice a year, much more frequently if they use their knives every day. There are three ways to go about it. Method 1. Use an electric sharpener. A good quality electric sharpener is an option, but I strongly discourage their use. First off, they remove a tremendous amount of material from your edge. Sharpen your knife a dozen times, and you'll have lost a good half centimeter of width, throwing it off balance and rendering any blade with a bolster, that is, most high-quality forged blades, useless. Second, even the best models provide only an adequate edge. If you don't mind replacing your knives every few years and are happy with the edge an electric sharpener gives you, this is an option, but there are much better choices. Method 2. Take it to a professional. Provided you have a good knife sharpener nearby and are willing to pay to have the service performed, this is a good option. But if you sharpen your blades a dozen or so times a year, as I do, this can get quite expensive. And all but the best pros use a grinding stone, which will take away much more material than is necessary from your blade, reducing its lifespan. Want to forge a stronger relationship with your blade? Choose the next option. Method 3. Use a sharpening stone. The best method by far. Not only will it give you the best edge, but it will also remove the least amount of material. Additionally, and I'm not kidding about the importance of this one, The act of sharpening your own knife will help you create a much stronger bond with your blade, and a knife that is treated respectfully will behave much better. You won't believe the difference a sharp knife can make in your cooking. Stones are designed to either be lubricated with oil or with water. I prefer water stones. Shopping and maintenance. When buying a water stone, look for a large one, at least 2.5 inches wide and 8 inches long and 1 inch thick. Stones come in various grit sizes, ranging from around 100 up to 10,000 plus. The lower the number, the coarser the grit, and the more material it will take off your knife. The higher the grit, the sharper the edge you will get, but the more strokes it will take to get you there. I recommend keeping 2 stones in your kit, one with a medium grit, around 800 or so, to perform major sharpening jobs, and one with a fine grit, at least 2,000, to tune the edge to a razor-sharp finish. For real pros, a stone with an ultra-fine grit, 8,000 and above, will leave a mirror-like finish on your blade, but most cooks won't notice the difference in terms of cutting ability. If you only have the budget or space for a single stone, I'd recommend one with a grit between 1,000 and 1,200. 2-sided stones are also available, coarse and fine grit, but these are usually of inferior quality. You will also need a stone fixer to repair any unevenness in the surface of your sharpening stones. I've yet to go farther down the rabbit hole to purchase a stone fixer. Both stones and fixers are available through Amazon.com. Carefully dry your stone after each use and store it wrapped in a kitchen towel in a dry, grease-free environment. Oil can soak into the porous material, ruining its sharpening ability and your chances of ever slicing your onions thin enough for that soup. And, again, remember to hone your knife on a steel every time you use it. While this process won't actually take any material off the blade, it will help keep the blade aligned, making slicing and dicing much easier. Step by step, how to sharpen a knife. Step 1. Work in batches. Although it's worth the effort, knife sharpening can take a bit of effort and time. If you're going to be setting up a station to sharpen a knife, think ahead and sharpen every knife that may need sharpening to get the whole process done in one session instead of several. Step 2. Soak your stones. When working with water stones, it's essential to submerge them in water for at least 45 minutes before using. If the porous stone is not fully saturated, it will dry out during sharpening, causing the knife blade to catch and giving your edge nicks and dings. If you have 2, soak both your stones as well as your stone fixer. Step 3. Set up your station. Place your stone on a towel laid on a cutting board. Keep a container of water nearby to keep your stone moistened during the sharpening process. The stone should be oriented with a short end parallel to the edge of the counter. Step 4A. Begin the first stroke. Hold your knife with the blade edge pointing away from you. Place the heel of your knife on the far edge of the stone and, holding the blade gently but firmly with both hands at a 15 to 20 degree angle and using even pressure, slowly drag the knife over the stone toward you down its length while simultaneously moving the knife so that the contact point moves toward the tip of the blade. Step 4B. Maintain the angle. Be careful to maintain the 15 to 20 degree angle as you pull the knife across the stone. Pressure should be firm but gentle, and the blade should glide smoothly across the stone. Step 5. Repeat. Each stroke should finish with the tip of the knife touching the bottom edge of the stone. Lift the knife, reset the heel at the top edge of the stone, and repeat. Step 6. Look for silty water. As you repeat the process, a thin film of silty-looking water should collect on top of the stone and on the blade. This abrasive liquid will gradually take material off the edge of your knife, sharpening it. Step 7. Check for burr. As you continue to repeat strokes on the first side, a tiny burr will eventually form on the other side of the blade. To check for it, place the blade on your thumb and pull it backward. If burr has formed, it should catch slightly on your thumb. With really fine grit stones, though, say 2,000 or above, you won't feel it. It may take up to 30 or 40 strokes before a burr forms, and that is the indication that you should switch and start sharpening the other side. Step 8. Start sharpening the second side. Turn the knife over so the edge is pointing toward you. Place the heel of the blade near the base of the stone, again maintaining a 15 to 20 degree angle, then gently push the blade away from you while simultaneously dragging it across the stone toward the tip. Step 9. Repeat. Your stroke should end with the tip of the blade against the top edge of the stone, still maintaining a 15 to 20 degree angle. Moisten your stone between strokes if it begins to dry out. Repeat for as many strokes as it took you to form the burr on the first side. Flip the knife back over and repeat steps 4 through 8, using fewer and fewer strokes per side until you are down to 1. The blade will not form a burr during this stage. Step 10. Fix the stone. After repeated use, your stone will begin to develop grooves in it, which can lessen its sharpening power. To fix it, use a low-grit stone fixer. Place the fixer flat against the stone, push it back and forth to grind down the stone and create a new flat surface. Step 11. Clean up. You should have a dedicated towel for this purpose, as the grit from the stone will never come out. After thoroughly drying the stone, allow to dry on a rack for at least a day, store it wrapped in its towel. Step 12. Hone and test your blade. After sharpening, hone your blade on a honing steel in order to get the edge in alignment, then test it for sharpness. Some people recommend trying to slice a piece of paper in half by holding it up and cutting through it. I find that even a relatively dull knife will pass that test, but fail at other kitchen tasks. The best test is to simply use the knife to prep a vegetable. Do you notice any resistance, or does it fly through that onion? Can you slice a ripe tomato thin enough to read through it? Yes? Then you're done. Essential small electric tools. There's no shortage of fun gadgets for the kitchen, but there are only a few that you absolutely need. Here's your basic starter kit in descending order of importance. Notice that the three most important items on this list are tools used for measuring. That is not an accident. 1. Instant read thermometer. This is it, folks. The one thing that more than any other purchase you can make will really revolutionize your cooking, especially if you often cook or have ever been afraid of cooking proteins. A good instant read thermometer is the only way to ensure that your roasts, steaks, chops, and burgers come out that perfect medium rare every time. Forget about poking meat with your finger, relying on inaccurate timing guides, or the nick and peek method. Buy a high-quality digital instant read thermometer and never serve a piece of over- or undercooked meat again. The splash-proof, super-fast ThermoPen by ThermoWorks has a hefty price tag, $86, but it's money well spent. It's head and shoulders above the competition, with a stunning range of negative 58 degrees to 572 degrees Fahrenheit, negative 50 degrees to 300 degrees Celsius, 1/10 of a degree precision, unparalleled accuracy, and a read time of under 3 seconds. Because of its wide range, you won't need separate meat, candy, and deep-fry thermometers. A single tool does all three tasks, and how. Aside from my knives, it's my favorite piece of kit. For the best inexpensive model, which is slower and more difficult to use, but still perfectly serviceable, check out the CDN Pro Accurate Quick Read Thermometer, $16.95. 2. Digital Kitchen Scale. If you're on the fence about whether or not you need a kitchen scale, jump to Weight versus Volume and listen to that section. Got it? See why you want a digital scale? Once I got one, I've used it almost every single day. A good digital scale will make inaccuracies and inconsistencies a thing of the past. And if you're the obsessive type, a scale can also help you figure out how much moisture your chicken lost during roasting, or exactly how far you've reduced that stock. Hooray! Things to look for in a good scale. At least 1 gram, 1/8 ounce accuracy, a capacity of at least 7 pounds, a tear zero function, measurements in both metric and imperial units, a large, easy-to-read display, and a fold-flat design for storage. The OXO Good Grips Food Scale with pull-out display, $45.95, has got all of that, plus a neat pull-out display that allows you to read measurements with ease, even when weighing large, bulky items that would otherwise obscure the screen. The only problem? Annoying fractions in the display instead of decimal places. Who the heck wants to measure 3/8 ounce? The Aquatronic Kitchen Scale by Salter, $49.95, lacks the pull-out display feature, but it uses easy-to-read decimals, which makes both math and looking cool in front of Europeans much easier. If you don't mind fractions, or intend to go all metric, then stick with the OXO. That's what I use. Otherwise, the Salter Aquatronic wins. 3. Digital Timer Stopwatch. Did you know that in restaurant kitchens, croutons are the number one item most burnt by line cooks? I can't tell you the number of times I've popped a tray of sliced bread in the oven for crostini, only to pull it out 30 minutes later after it sets off the smoke alarm. At least I used to. These days, I keep a Polder 3-in-1 timer, clock, and stopwatch, $13.95, around my neck at all times. It's got an easy-to-read display, an unobtrusive size, intuitive buttons, a loud alarm, a magnet for sticking it to the fridge, and a nylon lanyard for keeping it around your neck. So there's no way you can forget about your roasting peppers, even if you leave the kitchen. With both count-up and count-down functions, what more could you want in a kitchen timer? 4. Immersion Blender. Really? Some of you might be saying. You'd really say that your immersion blender is more important than your food processor or mixer? Well, if you rate importance by frequency of use, then absolutely. I use my immersion blender so frequently that I have it mounted on a holster on the wall right next to my stove and cutting board, ready at a moment's notice to emulsify a sauce, whip up a batch of mayonnaise, roughly puree some whole canned tomatoes directly in the pot, blend a cheese sauce, puree soup, whip cream in no time flat. You get the picture. It's a versatile tool, and you don't need a silly infomercial from the 1980s to tell you that. Want a pitcher full of margaritas? The regular blender's your friend. Need to make 2 quarts of pesto? Okay, pull out the food processor. But for smaller, everyday blending tasks, an immersion blender is the tool for the job. Ever get annoyed at those ropey pieces of egg white you come across when breading food? Blend the eggs for a few seconds, and they'll be perfectly uniform and smooth. You like froth on your hot chocolate? Heat it up in the pot and buzz it to create a luxurious foam. Lumps in your bechamel? All gone. How about if you want to make just a few ounces of perfectly smooth cauliflower puree or a half cup of mayonnaise? Yep, you can do that with an immersion blender too. The Braun PowerMax, which is only about $30, has been performing admirably at least 3 times a week in my kitchen for the past 11 years now. It's the most reliable sidekick I know. Unfortunately, it's not widely available these days, as I found out when stocking the kitchen at the Serious Eats World Headquarters. So there, we use the KitchenAid Immersion Blender, about $50, which works just as well. You can get it as part of a package that includes a whisk attachment and a mini food processor, but believe me, those are dust collectors, and you don't need them. 5. Food Processor. At a bare minimum, a good food processor should be able to finely chop dry ingredients like nuts and breadcrumbs. In order to do this, a processor must have an easy-to-use pulsing action and a motor that stops and starts on a turn. Roughly puree vegetables for things like marinades, dips, and rustic soups. For full-on smoothness, use a regular blender. Bowl shape, power, and blade design all affect how well a processor can accomplish this. It should also not leak. Grind meat. Short of a dedicated meat grinder or an attachment for a stand mixer, the food processor is the best way to grind fresh meat. Meat can be tough to chop, so a very sharp blade and powerful motor are necessary. Easily form emulsions when making sauces like mayonnaise or light vinaigrette. Bowl design can affect the way the blade makes contact with liquids. Knead bread dough quickly and efficiently. This is the most heavy-duty kitchen task of all, and the processor's effectiveness relies mostly on the power of the motor. I also like to have at least an 11 to 12 cup capacity processor, which makes grinding meat and making dough much easier. Some models come with a mini prep bowl that can be inserted into the main bowl for small tasks. These are cute, but essentially useless. Whatever the tiny bowl can do, I can do with a knife. That may take slightly longer, but if you consider the time it takes to wash the blade, bowl insert, and lid, it's no contest. There's also no use for a processor that's going to get gummed up or jammed every time it hits a hard nut or sticky dough. Particularly prone to failure are models with a side-mounted motor that drives the blade via a belt. Failing at even the easiest of tasks, those processors aren't worth the box they come in. Instead, look for models with a solid-state motor attached directly to the blade shaft, with no intermediary belt or chain. These take up a little extra space in terms of height, because the motor must be placed underneath the processor bowl, but that's an easy trade-off. The two best processors that fit all this criteria at a reasonable price are the KitchenAid 12-cup food processor, $199.95, and the Cuisinart Prep 11 Plus 11-cup food processor, about $165. And at such similar price points, admittedly much more expensive than many useless models, it all comes down to bowl design, and in this category, the Cuisinart wins. It's got a larger feed tube, as well as straight sides that ensure that all your food falls back down into the blade. For some reason, the KitchenAid has sloping sides. Ingredients can ride up the sides more easily and may not be chopped or emulsified properly. 6. Stand mixer with meat grinder attachment. A good stand mixer is a true workhorse for anyone who bakes more than occasionally. When selecting one, there are a few criteria that I look for. It should have a dough hook attachment and a powerful motor enough to mix at least 2 pounds of bread dough without straining, shaking, or burning out. It should have a whisk attachment to whip cream and to whip egg whites quickly and efficiently into frothy meringues and foams. It should have a paddle attachment to cream butter and sugar effortlessly, as well as make short work of mashed potatoes and sausage mixtures. It should feature planetary motion, meaning the whisk attachment spins around its axis in one direction and orbits around the work bowl in the opposite direction to maximize contact and mixing power. It should have a port for attachments, such as a meat grinder or pasta maker. Once again, just as with food processors, the epic battle for kitchen superiority, at least for the home consumer, comes down to KitchenAid and Cuisinart. Despite the fact that many manufacturers boost their motor wattages in their advertising, for instance, Cuisinart does a side-by-side comparison of their 800-watt SM55 mixer versus the 325 watts of the KitchenAid Artisan, these numbers mean very little. Within a given manufacturer's product lineup, it is an indicator of how powerful the motor will be, but the wattage is actually the power consumed by the mixer, not the power produced by the motor. It is a marketing gimmick, pure and simple. Given a choice between two motors that perform equally well, say the 325-watt motor of the KitchenAid Pro 500 versus the 800-watt motor of the Cuisinart SM55, it's actually better to pick the one with lower wattage and save on electricity. Both the KitchenAid and the Cuisinart have a meat grinder attachment available, an absolute must in my kitchen. It saves money and produces incalculably better results for burgers, sausages, meatballs, and meatloaves. Here, the Cuisinart's all-metal large meat grinder attachment, $128.95, has an advantage over KitchenAid's plastic and metal food grinder attachment, $49.95. But for the price of the Cuisinart attachment, you could buy a full-on dedicated meat grinder. The KitchenAid grinder has served me fine for years. While either brand will do you well, the KitchenAid Pro 500, $299.95, gets my vote for wedding registry priority numero uno. It's ideal for both heavy-duty bakers, who make bread at least a couple times a week and want a real powerhouse, and for those who will be mostly mixing batters, whipping cream, or even grinding meat. 7. Powerful blender. There are a ton of decent blenders on the market, far more than good stand mixers or food processors. Then again, there are also a ton of poor blenders out there. You want a blender that's powerful enough to puree soup to a completely smooth, velvety texture, with enough vortex action to thoroughly mix a thick blue cheese dressing or crush a pitcher full of ice for frozen drinks. You also want a blender with simple, easy-to-understand controls, the ability to pulse, and the capacity to slowly and evenly build up from a slow speed to a fast one in order to prevent the lid from blowing off when you blend hot foods too fast. Raise your hand if you've done this. Yep, thought so. The cream of the crop when it comes to blenders, the one that'll turn your shoes into soup or scare the pants off the fat kid in the Goonies, the one that'll turn all your chefy foodie friends spinach green with envy, is one from the Vitamix Pro Series. This is what every professional kitchen I've ever worked in has used, and with good reason. It's crazy powerful, has a very large capacity, and is built like a rock. They clock in at around $450 and up, placing them firmly out of the reach of most home cooks. Nearly as good and way cooler looking is the BlendTech, which, for around $400, will turn everything from a carrot to a full-sized alpine ski into dust. Don't believe me? Just Google it. Seriously, it's a great video. For a blender that won't break the bank, I'd go with the KitchenAid Vortex 5-speed blender, around $150. It has an easy-to-clean, wide polycarbonate pitcher and a blade that creates a big enough vortex that I can blend a full batch of cheese sauce for cheesy broccoli casserole in one go without it gumming up. 8. Rice cooker. There's no easier, more foolproof way to cook rice and other grains than in a rice cooker. Sure, you can cook rice in a pot, carefully monitoring the flame, hoping that you've added the right amount of water and that your rice isn't burning on the bottom, and taking it off the heat at just the right moment. But if you're anything like me, you've burnt one too many batches to fuss with that method anymore. With a rice cooker, you just add your rice and water, shut the lid, flip the switch, and go, with the added advantage that it'll keep the cooked rice or other grain hot for hours. Even the cheapest rice cooker will do. I had a $25 model I picked up in Chinatown that lasted me all through college and a good 5 years afterward. When I got married, I upgraded to a fancy pants model with a fuzzy logic processor and a nifty latching top that keeps the moisture level inside at the exact right level. I love my rice cooker almost as much as I love my instant read thermometer, which is just a hair more than I love my wife. Just kidding, honey. Essential kitchen hand tools and gadgets. A well-stocked vacation home probably has 2 to 3 drawers worth of tools, of which only half are even identifiable, and perhaps 3 or 4 are ever used. The following is a list of tools that you'll use all the time. Get 'em. 1. Utensil holder. First things first. If your tools are at the back of a drawer, you probably won't use them. And if you don't use them, you probably won't cook as often. And if you don't cook, what's the point of living, really? A utensil holder with a capacity of at least 2 quarts helps keep your tools handy right where you need them. If style is what you're after, Le Creuset makes handsome ceramic models in a variety of colors for around $25. If, on the other hand, pure functionality is your goal, Any old small bucket will do. I use a $5 metal version from IKEA. 2. Bench scraper. A bench scraper is one of those tools whose advantages aren't obvious until you start using it regularly. I keep one on my cutting board whenever I'm doing prep work. It quickly transfers chopped mirepoix to my saucepan or carrot peels to the trash. I use it to divide dough when making pizzas or ground beef when making burgers. For cleanup, a bench scraper makes short work of dough scraps that have dried onto the work surface, and it efficiently picks up tiny bits of chopped herbs and other debris. By the way, you should never use the blade of your knife to pick this stuff up off your board. It's dangerous, and it will rapidly dull the edge of your knife. A bench scraper also makes removing stickers from glass bottles or labels from plastic containers a snap. With its comfortable handle, sturdy construction, convenient built-in 6-inch ruler, and an edge sharp enough to rough-chop vegetables, the OXO Good Grips Pastry Scraper, $8.99, is the first choice for home kitchens. In my knife kit, however, I keep a lightweight plastic CR manufacturing scraper, 50 cents, which performs most of those functions at a fraction of the cost in a much more compact package. 3. Salt cellar and pepper mill. Why would anyone need a salt cellar? Under-seasoning food is the most common culinary blunder. Ask me why your food tastes blander than you'd like it to, and 90% of the time, all it needs is a little pinch of salt. Having a container of a salt in a prominent spot by your prep station or stove serves as a constant reminder to season, taste, season, and taste again until you get it exactly right. I guarantee that if you don't already have one, putting a salt cellar on your counter will make you a better cook. Any wide-mouthed, covered container with an easy-open lid will do, but a dedicated salt cellar does it with style. Mine is a wooden job with a flip-top lid to prevent dust, water, or oil from getting in. And pepper? If you've been using pre-ground pepper, do yourself a favor and buy an inexpensive jar of pepper with a built-in mill. Then taste the fresh ground stuff side by side with the pre-ground. Which would you rather be putting on your food? If that doesn't convince you to go out and buy yourself a pepper mill, I can only assume that you are dead from the tongue up. You'll want to invest in a mill that has a solid metal grinding mechanism. Cheap ones are usually made of plastic and will stop grinding after a year or less of regular use. Although $35 to $60 might seem like a big chunk of change, a real pepper mill will improve practically every savory food item you cook. Peugeot is the Rolls-Royce of pepper mills. Perfectly crafted, luxuriously styled, and awesomely efficient, these mills look good and grind like a dream. They also run upward of $55. More affordable and equally good, if totally utilitarian, is the Unicorn Magnum pepper mill, $36.90. It has a tough nickel-plated grinding mechanism, an easy-to-load design, and a quick grind-size adjustment screw. 4. Prep bowls of all sizes. Here's a mantra for aspiring chefs. An orderly kitchen is a good kitchen. Isn't it annoying trying to chop carrots on your cutting board when that little pile of parsley in the corner is getting in your way? Or what about frantically trying to scoop up the chopped ginger to get it into that stir-fry in progress before your bok choy wilts? I use several prep bowls with a small capacity, we're talking one cup or less, pretty much every time I cook to keep chopped aromatics, measured spices, grated cheeses, whatever, off my board, within easy reach and organized. This is what fancy cooks call their mise en place. In the cabinet directly above my cutting board, I have a couple of decent 25-cent ceramic condiment and cereal bowls from IKEA for this very purpose. If you want to go fancy, you can get sets of Pyrex clear glass prep bowls. Large mixing bowls are equally valuable. While the all-glass ones look nice up on the shelf, they're a total pain in the butt to work with. I remember many days at Cook's Illustrated magazine when we'd have to search through stacks and stacks of glass bowls while working on a photo shoot to find the one or two that weren't chipped on their edges. Where do these glass chips end up? On the floor? In the food? In my own kitchen, I'd rather not find out. Plastic bowls seem like a reasonable solution until you realize that plastic absorbs both stains and odors from oily and other foods. Pour a batch of olive oil and butter-based marinara sauce into a white plastic bowl, and you'll find that you're now the proud owner of an orange plastic bowl. Instead, I use inexpensive stainless steel bowls that I picked up from a restaurant supply store. If you don't have a good one near you, try the ABC Value Line brand from Amazon.com. I have about half a dozen in sizes ranging from a couple of quarts up to 5 quarts. They're lightweight and easy to handle, shatterproof, stainproof, breakproof, odorproof, and microwavable. Add to that their shallow design, which makes whisking and tossing a snap, and you've done made yourself a new best friend. 5. Wooden spoons. Short of being born a woman in Italy and waiting for your daughter to have a child, nothing makes you feel more like an Italian grandmother than slowly and deliberately stirring a lazily simmering pot of ragu with a wooden spoon. Blood runs deep between a good spoon and his cook. I nearly cried the day I cracked the handle on the spoon that had lasted me through 9 years and 13 different kitchens, a flat-headed beechwood model that I think I stole from my mother's hidden secondary utensil drawer. It was so well used that the handle had conformed to the shape of my hand, and the head had been worn into an angle that perfectly fit the corners of my Dutch oven. Whether stirring sauces, tasting soups, or gently whacking cheeky spouses who disturb you in the kitchen, a wooden spoon is the tool you'll want 90% of the time when you're cooking on the stovetop. I have half a dozen of various shapes and sizes that I use almost every time I cook. But if I had to pick a single spoon to perform every task, I'd choose one with a cupped section for tasting and a head that comes to a point rather than being completely round, making it easier to get into the corners of pots and pans. Whether you want a spoon with a completely flat section on the head or a more triangular profile is totally up to you. Like my favorite Beatles album, my favorite wooden spoon tends to waffle back and forth among the different spoons in my set. 6. Slotted flexible metal spatula. Flexible enough to flip tender pieces of delicate fish without breaking them, yet sturdy enough to get every last bit of a smashed burger off the bottom of your pan, a slotted metal fish spatula is an absolute essential in your toolkit. It's ideal for blotting excess grease off cooked steaks and chops. Just pick up the meat from the skillet and put it on a paper towel, still on the spatula, then transfer to the serving plate. The wide slots allow the grease to drain off easily. The spatula is lightweight and maneuverable enough to flip fragile eggplant slices in a skillet of oil, but it will also handle whole grilled pork chops with ease. Its slight flexibility lends it agility and control, unlike stiffer spatulas, which have their place in the kitchen. We'll get to that. And here's some good news. Most of the expensive models are far too stiff to do the job well. I keep a $25 Lampson Sharp model in my kit, and the even cheaper Peltex, around $15, is the standard in most restaurant kitchens. 7. Tongs. A sturdy pair of tongs is like a heat-proof extension of your fingers. Robust construction, slip-proof grips. Ever tried to grab a pair of stainless steel tongs with greasy fingers? A spring-loaded Class 3 lever design and scalloped edges, perfect for grabbing everything from tender stalks of spring asparagus to the biggest bone-in pork roast, are the qualities to look for in a good set of tongs. The OXO Good Grips 9-inch stainless steel locking tongs, $11.95, set the bar for quality. 8. Microplane Zester Grater. When you're talking fine-toothed graters, pretty much only one brand comes to mind. The Microplane Zester Grater, $14.95. It is more than just a useful gadget. It's the only one to get. My favorite thing to do with a zester is to go to town with it on an orange and watch as the little mountain of zest effortlessly grows on my cutting board. Wait. My favorite thing to do is grate delicate wisps of Parmigiano Reggiano over my bolognese. No, I take that back. My favorite thing is to grate fresh nutmeg on top of my gin flip. Or is it to sprinkle chocolate shavings over my souffle? Oh, but I do dearly love the lovely little mound of ginger that smells oh so lovely as it falls off the zester into my bowl. No, I've got it, and this time I'm sure. It's being able to throw out my confounded single-tasking garlic press and using my microplane to grate garlic into tiny, even mince. So many things to grate, so little time. 9. Whisks. They're essential for mixing quick bread batters or emulsifying hollandaise. Use one in a large pot of soup to incorporate seasoning much more quickly than a wooden spoon can. And a whisk is the best tool to whip cream or foam egg whites into frothy meringue. Models with stiff wires require much more movement and hard work from your wrist. The OXO Good Grips 9-inch whisk, $8.95, has thin, flexible wires which make whipping vinaigrettes into shape an effortlessly enjoyable endeavor. 10. Salad spinner. Yes, it will get your greens dry, and we all know that dry greens are better at holding dressing, right? But the salad spinner is actually one of the truly great multitaskers in the kitchen. I fill mine with water and pick herb leaves directly into the bowl. Once they're picked, I swish them around, lift them up in the basket, dump the sandy water, and spin dry. You can wash delicate items like berries, and then dry them in a salad spinner lined with a few layers of paper towels to extend their shelf life by a few days. Or take chopped tomatoes for a spin for easy seeding. The seeds slip through the basket while the flesh stays put. Washed mushrooms, sliced peppers, broccoli florets, anything you could think of stir-frying or sautéing, will cook better after a thorough drying in the spinner. Use the power of centrifugal force to whip away excess marinade from shrimp, chicken, or kebab meat. And if you've got a sturdy one with small slots, like the OXO's Good Grip Salad Spinner, about $30, there's no need to own a colander. Just drain beans, pasta, and vegetables in the spinner basket. 11. Stiff spatula. My Due Boy wide spatula, about $35, is exceedingly sexy in that mostly platonic, inanimate metallic object kind of way. It's got a business end that's 5 inches long, a generous girth of 3.9 inches at the front, and a hefty weight of 7.76 ounces. It's a size that can't be beat, just large enough to smash a ball of beef into a 4-inch patty or flip a couple portions worth of browning home fries without being so large that it doesn't fit into a small skillet. I've picked up a whole pizza off a hot stone with this thing. I'd like to see your wimpy plastic spatula do that. The blade and tang are formed out of a single piece of cast stainless steel, which clocks in at a thickness of 0.04 inch, 1 millimeter, or approximately 18 gauge. This is important. It allows you to lift a whole turkey or rib roast with reckless abandon. If you flip the spatula over, its keen and sturdy front edge substitutes handily for a paint scraper, allowing you to ensure that every last bit of flavorful, crisp crust stays firmly attached to your burger or steak instead of remaining in the pan. The handle is made from tough, durable polycarbonate and features a full tang for optimal strength and balance. This baby's gonna last a lifetime. And there's a musical bonus. When struck daintily against the cutting board, the spatula vibrates at precisely 587.33 hertz, really, with an outstanding overtone series. Even Stradivarius would be proud to apply his famous varnish to it. It's the very thing during that all-too-common situation when I desperately need to tune the fourth string of my guitar when applying cheese to my burgers. You'd be hard-pressed to find a better stiff spatula. 12. Japanese-style mandolin. Sure, you can train for years and spend hours a day sharpening and honing your knives to get to the point where you can whip out fennel wisps so thin you can read through them, or slice through your prep work at 100 onions per hour. And I'll be the first one to tell you that you're really, really cool. But for the rest of us, A mandolin makes quick work of repetitive slicing and julienning tasks. At one point in my life, I owned a fancy pants $150 French model. But you know what? It was heavy, bulky, and a pain in the butt to clean. And, with its straight blade, it didn't really do a great job. The Benriner Mandolin Plus, $49.95, on the other hand, features a sharp-angled blade that cuts much more efficiently than those awkward straight blades or clumsy V-shaped cutters. Walk into the kitchen of any 4-star restaurant in the city, and I guarantee you'll find at least a couple of Bennies, as they are affectionately called by line cooks, occupying a prominent place. Random trivia. Benriner means, oh, how handy, in Japanese, despite the fact that the Japanglish on the box front proclaims dry-cut radishes also okay. 13. Spider. A spider skimmer accomplishes almost everything a slotted spoon does, and better, at a fraction of the cost. It excels at fishing dumplings, vegetables, or ravioli out of a pot of boiling water, and its wire construction and relatively open mesh creates less turbulence in the liquid than a standard slotted spoon, making it much easier to fish out food. As for the task it was designed for, dunking and stirring foods for deep frying, the only thing that even comes close in terms of agility and control is a long pair of chopsticks, and even Mr. Miyagi would have trouble picking up peas from a pot of boiling water with a pair of chopsticks. Wire mesh spiders with bamboo handles are available at most Chinese grocers and restaurant supply stores for a few bucks a pop. But if you want something that'll last a long time, go with an all-metal spider like the Typhoon Professional Cook's Wire Skimmer, available for about $10 online. 14. Small offset spatula. Though these diminutive 4.5-inch long spatulas are intended for applying frosting to small pastries like cupcakes, you'll find that they have a slew of other uses in both the sweet and savory kitchen. Ever find yourself trying to unstick a fragile piece of food from a skillet with a spatula 3 times too big? The thin, flexible blade of a small offset spatula can slip under food items that even a fish spatula is too thick for. Pan full of slender breakfast sausages to flip one at a time? This is your tool. It's also indispensable for plating and presentation. A lightweight feel, comfortable handle, and ultra-thin blade make the Atico Small Offset Spatula, about $2, the industry standard, offering precision, control, and finesse. More control means less mess and better-tasting food. Oh, and it's good for cupcakes as well, if that's your bag. 15. Fine Mesh Strainer. A full-size colander is great if you've got a full pot of pasta to drain, but it rarely gets used otherwise, and even then, I just use the basket of my salad spinner. For smaller, everyday tasks like draining a can of tomatoes or beans, or ensuring that your crepe batter is perfectly smooth, a small hand strainer is what you need. I keep one hanging on a hook alongside my pots and pans for easy access. Inferior models consist of just a round mesh basket attached to a handle, but the 8-inch stainless steel strainer from OXO, $24.95, also has a loop of metal sticking on the opposite side of the basket. This allows you to set the strainer over a bowl for no-handed operation. It may seem a little pricey for a simple strainer, but its heavy-duty construction means it will last and last. 16. Chopsticks. I admit it, this one is a little controversial. Either you grew up using chopsticks and wouldn't be caught dead near a pot of simmering water or a wok full of hot oil without them, or you didn't. And, if so, you will probably wonder, do I really need them? But precise tips and a gentle touch will treat small, delicate pieces of fried or grilled food, say a tempura of squash blossoms or slender stalks of asparagus on the grill, far more gently than a relatively clumsy pair of tongs, which are better suited to large items like fried chicken or a rack of ribs. I use chopsticks for picking up bits of food from a stir-fry in progress to taste for doneness. They are also ideal for picking out a few slippery noodles from a pot of boiling water to make sure that they are perfectly al dente before draining. While regular chopsticks will do in many circumstances, high heat applications require extra long sticks made specifically for cooking. If you are lucky enough to have an East Asian kitchen supply store nearby, you can pick these up for a couple bucks a pair. Otherwise, you can find acceptable models online, like the extra long chopsticks from Hong Kong Imports Limited, $2. 17. Wine key. Regular corkscrews and $100 rabbit-shaped models will get your cork out, and fast. But with a little practice, a waiter's wine key will open wine bottles and beers just as fast and make you look infinitely cooler. The key is to use it as a lever. If you are pulling on it hard, you're doing it wrong. I keep a few in my cutlery drawer, like pens and razors. They tend to wander off into the world on their own from time to time, as well as one in my knife kit. 18. Citrus juicer. Every professional kitchen has its own hazing rituals, and as a young chef in training, I endured a period of time, a good 8 months or so, when my first duty every single morning was to ream 24 limes, 24 lemons, and a dozen oranges for fresh juice to use on the line during service. And the only tool I was allowed to use to do the job, lest I risk being called a wimp, believe me, a wimp is the last thing you want to be in the macho world of professional kitchens, was a wood lemon reamer from Scandicrafts Inc., $4. It was 2 weeks before I could complete the task from start to finish without taking a break to nurse my painfully swollen hands, and I went through 4 of the reamers in the course of those 8 months, slowly wearing them down until the grooved edges on the business end were as smooth and soft as river stones. This is not to say that it's a bad product. I'd strongly recommend it for the occasional juicer. But if you go through a lot of citrus juice, some people believe that lemon juice is as important as salt, just ask the Greeks, there are a number of other options on the market. I use the 2-in-1 juicer from Amco, 1995. You place the citrus cut side down in the perforated cup-shaped holder, then squeeze the handles together to extract the juice. It's fast, efficient, and much easier on the hands than a conventional reamer. The only issue is that it sometimes leaves a bit of juice behind, forcing you to manually squeeze the empty citrus shells for maximum extraction. And though it comes in small, green, medium, yellow, and large, orange sizes, intended for limes, lemons, and oranges, the yellow one works fine for both lemons and limes, making it the one to get. 19. Cake tester. I know many chefs and cooks who keep a cake tester tucked into the pen pocket of their whites, and none who use them to test cakes. Not that you can't test a cake's doneness with them, it's just why would you, when there are so many more interesting assisted poking tasks at which it excels? Essentially a heavy gauge wire with a handle, it's about as simple as a tool can get. The idea is that you poke it into the center of a cake and pull it out. If it comes out clean, the cake is done. So it's sort of like a glorified toothpick, but the fact that it's long and made of metal means that it's useful for all kinds of other things. The most obvious is testing the doneness of vegetables. Have you ever been told to stick a paring knife into a boiling potato to check if it's tender all the way through? The problem is that even the thinnest of paring knives makes a large stab wound in the potato, releasing starch and vastly increasing the chances that it'll break apart, particularly if you've bucked up for those tiny, tasty fingerlings. A cake tester neatly takes care of that problem. Want to know if those simmering carrots are tender enough to puree? How about if those baby radishes are cooked through? With a cake tester, you can find out without leaving behind any incriminating evidence. My favorite way to cook beets is in a tightly sealed foil pouch, a method that absolutely prevents you from poking them with a paring knife. A knife makes a hole in the foil too large to recover from. Not so a cake tester. I use my cake tester instead of a fork to decide whether or not my braising brisket or short ribs are fork tender. If the cake tester slides in and out with ease, the meat is ready. Lots of fish have membranes between layers of flesh that only soften at around 135 degrees Fahrenheit or so, a perfect medium rare. Stick your cake tester into that poaching salmon fillet, and if it meets resistance, that is, if it feels like punching through pieces of paper, it's undercooked. Barbecuing a pork shoulder low and slow? You can check if it's done without losing any juices through the grill grates. Finally, if you ever, God forbid, find yourself without your trusty thermometer by your side, a cake tester is the next best thing. Stick it into the center of your meat and leave it there for about 5 seconds, then pull it out and hold it under your lower lip, an area particularly sensitive to heat. You'll know instantly whether your steak is cold, warm, or hot in the center. As accurate as a thermometer? No. Good in a pinch? You bet. You can go all out and pay the $5 for a cake tester from OXO, which has a grippy black handle, but you may risk being made fun of for being too fancy pants. The cake tester from Fox Run, $1.29, is the cheapest I've found online. 20. Lots of squeeze bottles. I'm guessing a good 80% of you have read Anthony Bourdain's proclamation of love to his squeeze bottles in Kitchen Confidential. The indispensable object in most chefs' shtick is the simple plastic squeeze bottle, essentially the same objects you see at hot dog stands, loaded with mustard and ketchup. Mask a bottom of a plate with, say, an emulsified butter sauce, then run a couple of concentric rings of darker sauce, demi-glace or roast pepper puree around the plate, and drag a toothpick through the rings or lines. Sure, it's a good tool to have if outdated, overwrought plating is your thing, but there are better reasons to own a squeeze bottle than aesthetics. Namely, they'll make you a better cook and a better eater. Before squeeze bottles made their appearance in my kitchen, I'd eat salads perhaps once or twice a month, and only when I was hosting a dinner party. The hassle of making a fresh batch of vinaigrette just for myself and my wife was simply too much. Forget about using bottled dressing. These days, I keep a couple of different vinaigrettes ready to go in 12-ounce squeeze bottles in the fridge. Stick your finger over the top, give it a good shake, squirt it onto your greens in a mixing bowl, and boom, lunch is served. In order to make sure that chunky items like shallots or crushed nuts won't get caught in the tip, sometimes you've got to snip off the tip of the bottle with a paring knife or a good pair of kitchen shears. As far as